Rachel indicated the paper coffee cup, reaching past Michelle to throw it into the kitchen swing bin before heading back into the sitting room. While her back was turned, she grabbed Michelle's phone from the table. It was unlocked, so she scrolled quickly through the Photos app, taking screenshots of a few with her own phone before heading for the stairs. Immediately in front of her was Lola Jade's room, all too familiar from the crime scene photos. It was bleakly tidy, with toys displayed in regimented rows and her clothes, mostly pink dresses, hanging in the wardrobe on small satin hangers. From the top of the stairs, the landing made an L-shape, with the bathroom immediately to the right of Lola Jade's room, and Michelle's room at the front, occupying the space over the living room and taking up the entire width of the house. This too was extremely tidy, the frilly cream duvet and pillows neatly arranged, the bedside tables bare of clutter, and dresses and tops ordered by descending length in the wardrobe, shoes arranged by heel height below them. The landing itself was freshly decorated with a garish wallpaper featuring oversized purple poppies, the sort that was designed with a single feature wall in mind. Looking at it gave Rachel a headache. There was a fourth door, identical to the doors of the two bedrooms and the bathroom. Rachel opened it, releasing a pungent chemical gust of air freshener and detergent, and revealing a shallow storage cupboard stuffed with loo roll, multiple cleaning products, and spare carrier bags. There were scented oil plug-ins in the landing sockets, releasing a sickly perfume. She used her own phone to take pictures of everything. As she came downstairs, Michelle was carrying two mugs of tea back into the living room. "I've got biscuits if you want them," trying to avoid them. Michelle looked Rachel up and down. "The knee injury, I'm not burning up as many calories as usual." "Fair enough." This was said without any genuine interest. "Do you have any other pictures I could see? Anything that might help?" Michelle took a photo album from the sparsely filled bookshelves and handed it to her. Inside were pictures dating back to the early days of Gavin and Michelle's marriage. The wedding shots themselves showed a tanned, good-looking man with a receding hairline, awkward in a cravat, and the bride with a wet-look perm and a shiny white toilet roll cover of a dress. There were pictures from what looked like a stag weekend, and some of a bare-chested Gavin on a beach next to another tanned and good-looking man. "Who's this?" asked Rachel, although the two men were so alike she was pretty sure she knew the answer. The dolphin tattoo on Gavin's left forearm was the only way she could be sure which was him. "That's Gavin, his brother Andy. They used to go on lads' holidays together." "So they're close?" "Yeah, thick as thieves." Then there were pictures of a pregnant Michelle and Lola Jade's baby pictures, a few of the three of them on family holidays, all looking miserable despite the sunshine. "Actually, I think I'll have that biscuit after all. It's been a while since breakfast." While Michelle was in the kitchen again, Rachel took out her phone and snapped images of the pages that featured Gavin and Andy. "I can't find the biscuit, sorry." Michelle was back in the room, snatching the photo album from Rachel and holding it defensively against her chest. "I just needed a picture of Gavin, so I can show people who we're looking for." She relaxed her grip a fraction. "Oh, okay, only he doesn't look like that now. He's got less hair." "Well, if you could send me an up-to-date photo, that would be helpful." Michelle narrowed her eyes. "You said you were from the NCA. Does that cover other countries?" Rachel inclined her head. "There are a few of us that used to be Interpol before the NCA took it over. I happen to be one of them. But we cover cases on the mainland UK too, wherever our expertise is needed, really." "So you're going to go to Spain, right?" "It's something we'll be looking into, certainly. Anyway, thanks for your time today. It was helpful." Rachel stood up, giving Michelle her cue to stub out the cigarette and walk her to the front door. Outside, WPC Nichols was sitting bolt upright in the patrol car, munching on a ham sandwich. "Find anything?" Rachel inquired as she climbed back into the passenger seat. WPC Nichols handed her phone to Rachel, and she examined the shots of the inside of Michelle's bin. "Interesting."
"Is it?"
"It certainly is. Do me a favour and send them to me, please." How'd you get on? Brickall inquired when she was back at the NCA building. Not sure. Rachel gave a cursory debrief of the visit, then uploaded the photos she and WPC Nichols had taken to Hurricane forensic software and examined them in greater detail. Every picture tells a story. Wasn't that what they always said? Whoever they were. She washed down some tramadol with a can of Coke and turned back to the Lola Jade file. She flicked through it until she found the original MG11 form recording Gavin Harper's witness statement. My name is Gavin Harper. I live at Flat B, 209 Carlisle Road, Eastwell, Surrey. On the afternoon of 10th of May, I received a phone call from my brother asking if I knew about Lola Jade, who's my six-year-old daughter. I said I didn't know what he was talking about, and he told me that he'd heard on the local news that she was missing. I tried to phone my wife, Michelle Harper, but I couldn't get through. I drove over to the family home, 57 Willow Way, but I wasn't allowed to see or talk to Michelle. Her sister, Lisa Urquhart, was there and said she was too upset. I wanted to join in the search for Lola Jade, but I was told it was best to let the experts get on with it. I was told I should go home and wait there until the police could come and speak to me. It's true that relations between my wife and I had broken down and that we were arguing over custody and my access to Lola Jade. I know nothing at all about her disappearance. Signed by Gavin Thomas Harper. Witnessed by DS2394 Rajavi. With the photos the CSO had taken of Lola's bedroom spread out in front of her, Rachel then reread the entire forensic report, including the lab results that were stapled to it. And then stopped in her tracks with a sharp intake of breath. She had assumed the DNA found belonging to Gavin Harper was hair or skin, something not unusual for a parent frequently in their child's bedroom. But it wasn't. A brief typed sentence confirmed something she'd missed. The sample found was seminal fluid. Chapter 5. At 6:15 the next morning, Rachel was out of bed and climbing into a sports bra, a vest, and a pair of loose athletics shorts that she used for running in hot weather. Howard was waiting for her at the gym, standing next to the pull-up bars. "Up you jump, Rachel," he said, nodding in their direction. "Howard, I can't. I don't have enough upper body strength." "Exactly why you need to work on it." Inhaling hard and holding her breath, Rachel bent her knees and mustered as much aerial projection as she could, but only succeeded in banging her wrist on the bar. Howard gripped her round the waist and lifted her up as though she weighed no more than a child. She hesitated, savouring the moment of weightlessness, then grabbed hold. He let go, and she dangled awkwardly. "All right, now pull. Pull hard." Rachel managed to hoist herself a couple of inches higher, but then lost her grip and fell, landing awkwardly at Howard's feet and sending a painful shock through her damaged knee joint. She grimaced. "Come on, again. You need to keep trying." "I want to box." She was aware that she sounded whiny. "Do this, then you can box. You need to work on your dead hang. Literally, hang like a dead man. Person," he corrected himself. "If your lats and chest are tight, you're going to damage your shoulders and spine when you're boxing. Hang like you're dead." 30 sweaty minutes and 10 pull-ups later, Howard allowed her to give the punch ball a good beating. She headed to work with aching arms and shoulders but a glow of satisfaction. "Your face is as red as a beetroot," observed Brickall. "Early morning shag, was it?" Rachel shot him a warning glance. "Okay. How did you get on with the lovely Michelle, then?" Rachel shook her head slowly. "Not sure. She's definitely buying into the possibility that Gavin Harper's disappearance and Lola's are related. And I did find out that he's very close to his brother, Andy, so I reckon we talk to him next." "Wasn't he interviewed?" Rachel shook her head. "They almost certainly spoke to him informally, but there's no MG11 on the file. See if you can track him down." Half an hour later, Brickall slapped his desk in frustration.
I'm getting fuck all here. According to the electoral roll, the only Andy Harper in the Eastwell area is 68, so he can't be Gavin Harper's brother.
Then we widened the search. Rachel scoured local newspaper reports and social media but drew a blank, apart from the Facebook account of a 14-year-old Andy Harper.
See, said Brickell triumphantly, the man doesn't exist.
Perhaps he's moved out of the area. Try the General Register office. Brickell frowned.
That's only going to provide a record of his birth, not where he lives now.
Right now, it's all we've got. After an hour and a half of trawling the General Register database, Brickell found a handful of Andrew Harpers born between 1970 and 1990, but none of the family details matched Gavin Harper's.
Waste of bloody time, he grumbled, and went off to find lunch.
Rachel went back to the drawing board, searching online articles about the case. There was an interview in one of the many hysterical Lola Jade pieces with Gavin Harper's father.
Lola Grandad speaks out, my son is no killer.
The photo was of an overweight man with iron grey hair and a jowly face that would once have been handsome. The gutter journalist writing the piece mentioned Terry Harper agreeing to meet him in his local pub, and the photo showed him standing outside it. Rachel googled it. The hand and flowers Whiteley. She then checked the electoral register and found Terry's address on a housing estate in Whiteley, a few miles from Eastwell. Brickell wandered back into the office with a slice of pizza and a can of Coke. Rachel shook her head vigorously as he went to sit down.
You can eat that in the car. We're off to talk to Lola Jade's grandfather.
Terry Harper was wary, which she had expected. He was a short man, so short that even Brickell loomed over him. The three of them filled the cramped hallway of his modest bungalow.
How much will I get paid? He asked when she told him they wanted to talk about Lola's disappearance.
Paid?
By your paper.
We're not journalists, she corrected him. We're police officers, working in crime investigation support. Terry tutted at this, but led them through into a small over-furnished living room. There were family photos on display, including one of Gavin and Michelle's wedding, the bride resplendent in her shiny meringue. Rachel poised herself gingerly on a Dreylon armchair, decked out with an antimacassar that reminded her of her mother's house. Brickell took the sofa.
"I'm going to come straight to the point, Mr. Harper," he said. "Do you know where Gavin is, or why he's disappeared?"
He shook his head vehemently.
"Honest to God, I don't. I mean, I've tried phoning him, obviously, but his mobile's disconnected. All I'm hoping..."
"Do you think he has Lola Jade with him?"
Rachel leaned forward and engaged eye contact.
Terry hunched his shoulders in a helpless gesture.
"I mean, he must have, mustn't he?"
Rachel looked at him sharply. "Why do you say that, Terry?"
He shrugged. "It's just the obvious explanation. Why else would he do a runner like that? But he wouldn't hurt her, I know that. He wouldn't hurt a hair on that precious kiddie's head."
Rachel thought back to the DNA sample found in Lola's room. How was her relationship with her dad? Did she enjoy spending time with him?
"She adored him. Adores him," he corrected himself.
"So there were no issues between them?" Rachel was aware that she was pussyfooting, but she couldn't quite bring herself to ask if he thought his son was abusing his own daughter. Terry shook his head.
"To be fair, there was that time when Michelle reported him to the police for not taking her back on time. But he had his reasons," he added darkly.
Rachel raised her eyebrows.
"Husband and wife stuff, you know. She likes playing games, does our Michelle."
Brickell shot Rachel a look. "Go on," Rachel said to Terry.
"Their relationship was what you might call volatile.
Michelle seemed to think Gavin could be in Spain," Brickell interjected. "Do you think that's true?"
"Could be. He spent time over there, you know, speaks some Spanish, so I suppose it would be relatively easy for him."
"And your other son, where is he?" demanded Brickell. Terry looked confused.
"Me other son? I've only got the one, Gavin.
It was Rachel's turn to look confused.
What about Andy?
The penny dropped, and Terry's face relaxed into a smile. Oh,
Andy. Andy's not mine. He's my ex-wife's kid. He and Gav are half-brothers, you know. Pat and I split when Gavin was a nipper, and she remarried soon after and had a couple more kids, Andy and Karen.
Oh, I see. Rachel smiled back. That would explain their singular failure to track down Andy Harper. Michelle showed me photos and they were so alike, I just assumed they both looked like their mother.
So, Andy's surname?
Asked Brickle.
Whittier. Andy Whittier.
Easy to find someone in 2017 when you've got the name right, mused Rachel, as Brickle drove them back along the main road that led back towards London.
I've just gone into Facebook and found him right away.
She held up her phone. If this is correct, then Andy Whittier's still living in the Eastwell area.
Bloody hell, does that mean you want me to turn round?
Rachel shook her head. We could get his home address from the PNC, but right now he's probably going to be at work, not at home.
His employment status will be on Facebook too, dummy.
Rachel checked, and sure enough it was.
According to his profile, Andy works at JBH Distribution Limited, she read out to Brickle, then broke into a grin.
It supplies building and construction materials, and conveniently the address is London Road, Whiteley. We just passed it about 1/4 mile back.
Swearing under his breath, Brickle executed a sharp U-turn.
The receptionist at JBH explained that there were two shifts, early, from 7:30 until 4, and late, from 11 till 7:30. Andy Whittier was on an early that day. It was now 3:30, so they parked outside and waited.
One thing, Rachel said, washing down painkillers with a bottle of water. Did you read the forensic report from Lola's room?
Brickle shook his head.
The paternal DNA sample found on the carpet. It was semen, for fuck's sake. What's that all about?
I'm pretty sure Surrey CID will have asked him that. Funny old thing, though. We can't question him ourselves because he's done a bunk.
Rachel sighed. Mind you, I can't find anything that suggests he's a pedo.
That doesn't rule it out. But then the presence of the DNA doesn't rule it in either. Any number of reasons you might get your jizz smeared in your kid's room.
Rachel looked askance at him. Seriously, Detective Sergeant? And Harper wasn't living there either. Bit bloody weird.
Brickle exhaled hard, making a whistling sound through his teeth.
The whole case is weird if you ask me.
Workers from the early shift had started streaming out of a side entrance.
Okay, who are we looking for?
Rachel took out her phone and flicked back through the images she had captured from Michelle's photo album until she reached the one of Gavin Harper with his brother, holding it up to Brickle. The two men were sitting under a coconut palm pergola at a beachside bar, shades on the top of their heads, a strip of cobalt blue sea in the background. At 4:05, a man strode into the car park, rucksack slung over his shoulder, car keys in hand, and Brickle said, "Bingo!"
Andy!
Rachel climbed out of the car and placed herself between Whittier and his own vehicle.
Andy, hi, my name's D.I. Rachel Prince. Could we have a word?
He tilted his shoulder down and attempted to barge past her.
Sorry, I don't want to talk to you. We've all had enough hassle.
Just an informal chat?
Rachel used her recent boxing training to block him.
Otherwise, we'll be bringing you into London with us for a formal interview.
He hesitated, looking her up and down again. He had an attractive face, Rachel thought, with regular features and warm brown eyes.
Okay, he sighed, but not here. There's a place a couple of 100 yards up the road towards the bypass. Sid's Caff.
Chapter 6 Sid's Caff was a greasy spoon favoured by the lorry-driving fraternity, all four micro and strip lighting. The three of them had mugs of stewed tea, and Andy ordered a full English, which she set about with the gusto of the condemned man at his last supper.
Brickle looked on enviously.
"Sorry, bloody starving," he said through a mouthful of baked beans and sausage.
"That's fine."
Rachel stirred sugar slowly round her creosote-coloured tea.
Take your time. I expect you know what we're going to ask you anyway.
If I know where Gav's gone.
He dabbed bread and butter in the baked bean juice and wolfed it down.
Spot on, Brickle confirmed. That deduction hardly takes a criminal genius.
Andy shrugged, starting to relax a little now that his blood sugar was on the rise.
Sorry, you're wasting your time. I have no bloody idea where Gav is.
Your father, sorry, Gavin's father, your mum's ex, thinks he's taken Lola Jade and gone abroad.
Andy returned to looking down at his plate. Like I said, I wouldn't know anything about that.
Rachel nodded, reaching into her bag and groping reflexively for the blister pack of painkillers.
The two she took earlier didn't seem to be working. Andy watched her pop out another one and swallow it with her tea.
Bad knee, she said hurriedly.
He nodded sympathetically.
Loads of the guys at work have knackered their backs and knee joints loading the rigs.
Can we get back to your niece? Said Brickle sharply. You and your brother are very close. You must have an idea where he is.
Andy laid down his knife and fork.
And I've just told you I don't.
Look, our main objective at this point is to talk to Gavin. You have to agree he has some questions to answer. If he didn't take Lola, then why did he up and vanish?
How did he up and vanish?
Rachel levelled her gaze at Andy, who was mopping his plate in a studied fashion.
What's your theory when it comes to Lola Jade?
If she was dead, then I reckon you lot would have found her by now. But on the other hand, in my opinion, you've been pretty bloody useless, so who knows?
Brickle scowled at him.
I'm not sure that's fair.
Rachel drained what was left of her tea.
Surrey police threw a hell of a lot of resources at the investigation. Every single bit of available manpower was used in the search.
Andy leaned back in the chair, giving her a sceptical look. And the case has now been passed from Surrey Police to us at the National Crime Agency. You know, fresh eyes.
We've already talked at length to your sister-in-law, Brickle chipped in. She's the one who told us you and Gavin are close.
Andy gave a mirthless laugh.
Michelle! Jesus Christ!
You don't have a very high opinion of her, I take it?
He pulled a face.
Well, you've met her, right? She made Gav's life hell when they were together. Never happy, never satisfied. One minute she wants him to split up, the next she wants him back, then she chucks him out. Blowing hot and cold, demanding his attention one minute, ignoring him the next. Poor sod never knew where he was with her. And then she goes and makes up stories about him abducting Lola, as well as other stuff.
Rachel looked straight into the brown eyes that now flashed with indignation. What do you mean by that?
Implying things about Gav that were a load of crap. He'd never have done the things she was talking about.
His voice trailed off.
You're talking about sexual abuse?
Rachel thought it was time to dispense with euphemism.
Andy nodded. Never. Not Gav. Not in a million years.
So Michelle made up a story that her husband was interfering with his own daughter.
Let's just say, of the two of them, I know who was the better parent.
I got the impression that she's devoted to her daughter, Rachel countered.
He shrugged. You could say that, but at least Lola knew where she was with her dad.
Andy buttered the last piece of bread left on his side plate.
Well, good luck anyway, starting from scratch months down the line. Your chances of finding her must be slim to none.
Brickle scowled again. The clock over the counter said 4:45, and the crowd of truck drivers was starting to thin. Andy threw his paper napkin onto his plate and pushed it away.
Sorry, but I'm going to have to get off. The wife will be wondering what's happened to me.
Brickle held up a hand.
Hold on a minute. Can we get back to where we started? Gavin's whereabouts.
I understand he'd spent time in Spain.
Andy shrugged. When we were young, before we both married, we used to spend time repping in the resorts in the Med, but that was over 10 years ago.
Michelle said something about Torrevieja.
Andy reached for his wallet, ducking his head to avoid eye contact as he counted out coins.
I don't know anything about that.
Please, Andy.
Rachel tried to reinstate eye contact.
It's in everyone's interest for us to find Gavin.
He nodded briefly, still avoiding her gaze.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, he could be anywhere. He might not even be abroad.
He had stood up to leave, but Brickle was quickly on his feet, blocking his path.
Gotta go, okay?
Andy said firmly, whacking Brickle with his rucksack as he pushed past. Sorry, but I can't help you.
Is there an address he might go to? A contact who might be helping him?
Rachel called as she limped after him. But Andy strode straight outside to his car, jumped in and drove off without looking back in their direction. Rachel was already Googling flights as Brickle drove them back to London.
Alicante or Murcia, the airports for Torrevieja. Michelle's given us a lot more to go on than Andy has.
He gave us fuck all, Brickle pointed out.
So we might as well get on with it and head out there as soon as possible, I reckon. I'll sort it with Patton tomorrow.
It was now rush hour, and they were crawling with painful slowness through the outer suburbs. By the time they reached the centre of the city, it was 7 p.m.
Makes sense if I drop you at home, Brickle suggested. It's a bit late to go back into the office.
Rachel was about to agree when her phone rang. The same number as before. Stuart's number. Her whole body tensed.
You okay?
Brickle eyed her sharply. He missed nothing, unfortunately. They were pulling up outside her block of flats when Rachel suddenly gripped his forearm.
Don't stop! She barked.
A familiar figure was standing on the pavement outside the door to her building. Stuart!
Keep driving! Drive!
Brickle changed up through the gears and hurtled to the end of the street, yanking the steering wheel left round the corner. Then he pulled over abruptly, stalling the engine and making the driver behind him hit the horn and flick a V sign in their direction. Brickle waved his warrant card in response, then turned to face Rachel.
What the fuck's going on, Prince?
I thought I saw my ex, or it might not have been him. I'm not sure. Fuck!
She slammed the heel of her hand against her forehead.
Jesus, you're so fucking jumpy. What exactly is the problem?
I just don't want to see him, that's all.
Is this the same one that was phoning you?
Rachel nodded.
Want me to come with you and check if it's him?
She shook her head.
No, it's fine. Just wait here with me for a bit until he's gone.
If it is him. I'm not even sure.
But thanks, Mark.
They waited in awkward silence for a few minutes. Then Rachel reached for the door handle.
No, wait, Brickle started the engine. Let me drop you at the front door, then we'll both know you were imagining things.
There was no one waiting outside the building when they got there. Rachel patted Brickle's arm as she got out of the car.
Thanks. We'll sort the Spain trip in the morning, okay? Make sure you pack plenty of sunblock.
He grinned at her.
Like I've said before, you're such a weirdo, Prince.
I think we can agree I'm never going to win bloody Olympic gold.
Rachel stepped back from the punch bag, shoulders heaving from the effort, sweat trickling from her temples, cheeks flushed bright pink. It felt good. Her anxiety levels had plummeted, and for a while, at least, she hadn't given any thought to Stuart Ritchie.
Don't be so hard on yourself. You're doing well.
Howard went to pat her shoulder, then, seeing the slick of perspiration, hung back. His hand hovering.
I'm seeing real progress.
Rachel's right knee was still sore, but after only a few sessions she could feel that she was toning up, gaining muscle. She went to grab her towel from the bench and reflexively reached into her kit bag for a couple of pills, sloshing them down with water from her sports drink. Howard's silhouette loomed over her, biceps bulging in his corporate gym t-shirt, and of course his eyes zeroed in on the tramadol. Before she could escape, he pulled the blister pack from her hand and studied them.
You want to be very careful with these things. They're extremely addictive.
Rachel snatched the pills back and shoved them into her bag.
Maybe you should, you know, go and speak to your GP about an alternative.
Rachel stomped past him, swung the gym door open and headed for the car park.
Maybe you should mind your own fucking business, she shouted over her shoulder.
Sitting in her car, she rested her head on the steering wheel for a few seconds, waiting for her breathing to steady.
Shit, she thought. That was a stupid thing to do.
She'd had a terrible night's sleep, between the pain in her leg, her paranoia about Stuart having discovered where she lived, and her mind churning over the details of the Lola Jade Harper case. She'd mentally revisited Michelle's house, replaying every detail of what she'd seen and heard. And there was Andy Whittier. He had been evasive, and her experience left her in no doubt he was hiding something. They should interview him again, in a more formal setting. But first, Spain. As she trudged into the office, one glance at Brickall let her know that he was in a foul mood.
What?
She asked, as she lowered herself carefully onto her desk chair.
What do you mean, what?
You've got a face that looks like a wet bank holiday weekend in Scunthorpe, only less fun.
Bloody Patton won't let me go with you to Spain. The Bogdani case is going to court this week and I'm needed to give evidence. Oh, Christ, Rachel rolled her eyes. I was counting on you to do the driving. Thanks a bleeding bunch. Good to know where my skills lie.
And I was relying on you for feedback and insight too, obviously. Rachel leaned back in her chair, closing her eyes. She usually enjoyed the international element of the job, but this morning she was too tired to summon any enthusiasm for the trip, especially now that she would be going alone.
We'll have to do our video conference calls, okay? I'll still need to run stuff by you and have you run data checks for me. Detective Sergeant?
Brickall sighed and nodded reluctantly.
Good. I guess I'd better go and see Jeanette about a flight and schedule a case conference with those lovely people at Child Protection for when I get back.
By lovely people, you mean lovely person, our Mills and Boone hero.
Rachel flushed slightly, which seemed to be a reflexive response whenever she thought about the dark, handsome and faintly mysterious Giles Denton.
Whatever, just do it, douchebag.
Chapter 7. The first thing she noticed was the bright sunlight streaming in through slatted blinds. The second was the thrumming pain and stiffness in her right leg. Rachel had arrived at Mercia Airport at 8 the previous evening and driven a rental car for an hour to the Costa Blanca resort of Torrevieja, a magnet for British tourists. Now, hobbling out of bed, she pushed back the blinds and stepped out onto the balcony, squinting into a cloudless sky. A pristine aquamarine hotel pool twinkled below her, and she longed to go for a morning swim, but knew it would only make her leg worse. She would allow herself a poolside lounging session later, but first there was work to be done. The Asturias Bar was on the promenade, a paved, pedestrianized thoroughfare fringed with towering palms. On one edge was the beach, dotted with colourful umbrellas, and on the other a strip of bars, ice cream parlours, restaurants and Irish pubs. Inside the bar there was restaurant service, and a large awning at the front gave shade to more tables and chairs. A couple of hardened Brits were sitting outside, already downing pints of lager when Rachel arrived at 10 a.m. She showed her warrant card and was taken to the manager in the back office, a small wiry man with a comedy moustache called Jorge. He nodded vigorously when Rachel showed him the photo of Gavin Harper.
Yes, I remember. He worked here.
When?
Jorge shrugged. Long time ago, maybe 10 years.
Have you seen him recently? More recently than that? This was met with blank incomprehension, but Jorge summoned one of the waiters, a young Latvian called Andris, who spoke near-perfect English and stood in as a translator. Yes, Jorge remembered Gavin, but hadn't seen him since he worked there. No, Gavin hadn't been into the bar recently, and he hadn't seen him anywhere in Torrevieja in recent months.
Ask him if he can think of anyone else who knows Gavin Harper, anyone he was friends with.
Andris relayed this, and told Rachel that yes, there was a guy called Christian Aguado who used to be friendly with Gavin Harper and who still worked at a nightclub called Discoteca 33.
He might know something, Andrew said. But from Jorge's Hispanic shrug, Rachel was not so sure. She stayed and drank her coffee and ate some churros, and then worked her way methodically along the promenade, showing Gavin's photo to everyone she could find. After 3 hours, her leg was throbbing, her right foot puffy, and she had no leads at all. She decided to limp back to the hotel, put on her bikini, and rest by the pool until it was dark and resort nightlife swung into motion. Discoteca 33 was in a semi-residential street that led down to the Cala Cornuda beach. Now that it was nearly November, peak holiday season was over, and at 8:30 it was still early for the party crowd, so there were only a handful of other people in the club. Rachel perched herself on a bar stool, feeling conspicuous. Within 20 seconds, a portly man with greased back hair sidled up to her. "Buy you a drink, lovely lady?" Lovely lady? Hard to believe men still said that. She grimaced, wishing she hadn't put on a sheer pale pink shirt, but had instead stuck to something more workmanlike. Rachel turned down the offer and bought herself a glass of sangria, using the interaction with the bartender to ask if he knew who Christian Aguado was.
"Sure."
He pointed to his own tanned chest, which was exposed by a shirt unbuttoned almost to the waist, and looked as though it had been oiled.
"I am Christian. How can I help?"
My first piece of luck, thought Rachel. Few cold cases were solved without a certain amount of it. She added in a generous tip and explained that she was looking for Gavin Harper. Christian frowned.
"Of course I know him, but he's not here."
"Not here in Torrevieja, you mean?" He nodded. Rachel scrutinized his face for the tells of deception but saw none. "When did you last see him?" He thought for a moment, polishing a wine glass on a cloth.
"Maybe 2-3 summers ago, on holiday with La Ninita. His little girl."
"And if he was here in Torrevieja at the moment, where would he be? Where does he stay?"
"But he's not here," Christian repeated stubbornly. "If he was here, I would know this. I know everyone in this town."
He flapped his towel around the bar area to indicate that this was his kingdom, then rearranged his shirt front to display the optimum amount of pectoral muscle.
"People tell me everything."
"What if he was hiding? If he didn't want anyone to know he was here?" Rachel persisted. Christian gave a Hispanic shrug and went back to polishing glasses.
"When he's here, he stays in Apartamentos Playa Soleada. But he is not here. This is the truth."
Rachel googled the apartments while she was finishing her sangria. They were just around the corner, which would explain why Gavin was a regular at Discoteca 33. She walked past on her way back to the hotel, showed her warrant card and the photo of Gavin to the building manager. He was also adamant that Gavin wasn't staying there, and even offered up all the last month's CCTV tapes from the lobby by way of confirmation. "Maybe," Rachel told him. "I'll get back to you." Back at the hotel, she sat with her right leg raised on pillows, a makeshift ice pack on her knee, and Skyped Brickle. On a plate in front of him was his evening dietary staple, pizza laden with hot sauce, and his mood was buoyant.
"Turns out the trial's actually quite good crack."
"Really?"
"Of course it doesn't hurt that the junior barrister on the prosecution side is a stunning brunette."
Rachel grinned. "Asked her out yet?"
He tapped the side of his nose. "Let's just say I'm working on it. How's your jammy little skive on the Costa?"
Rachel sighed. "I'm pretty sure Harper's not here in Torrevieja. I've got a load of CCTV tape to go through tomorrow," she added. "It could prove useful, I suppose." Brickle inhaled from a can of lager.
"What's your gut telling you, Prince?"
"That we're wide of the mark. I've been looking at the photo of Gavin and Andy together at some beach bar every time I made inquiries, and something was bugging me. I've remembered what it was. The same building there in front of appeared in most of the photos of them in Michelle's albums. Hold on a second." She reached for her phone and sent the image to Brickle so that they could look at it together. The bar in the background had a tin roof, a coconut palm pergola, and the exterior walls were painted bright turquoise, daubed with blocks of bright red and green. Over the entrance hung a driftwood sign with lettering burned into it by hand.
Rachel zoomed in as far as she could and could just about make out the name, Tiago's.
"Hang about," said Brickall suddenly. "It's obvious, you plank. The red and green rectangles are the Portuguese flag. They're in Portugal."
Before Rachel had a chance to reply, he consulted his phone and held it up triumphantly to his laptop screen.
"Here you go. Tiago's bar in Albufeira. It's the Algarve."
Rachel shook her head slowly.
"Shit. And he did say they'd travelled all over the Med. So do you reckon it could be in Portugal?"
"Only one way to find out." The next morning, Rachel phoned Nigel Patton's assistant, Jeanette, and enlisted her help in getting to the Algarve. It was not straightforward. If she flew, she would have to change planes in Lisbon, but there were no available seats that day anyway, or the next day. If she drove all the way, she wouldn't be able to return her Spanish-registered car in Portugal. A train would take 11 hours, which she couldn't face. The resourceful Jeanette suggested she drive to Seville, leave the car, and take one of the very frequent buses from there to Faro. "I definitely think that's your best option. You'll be able to get to Albufeira by early evening, no problem. It's a longish taxi ride from Faro, or there's a train that only takes 20 minutes. "Thank you." Rachel didn't point out that this route would still mean at least 5 hours behind the wheel. Her gammy leg was hardly Jeanette's problem. She downed a couple of painkillers and hit the road, reaching a hot, dusty, traffic-clogged Seville in the middle of the afternoon. A woman at the car rental office saw her limping pathetically with her luggage and offered the services of one of their pickup drivers to drop her at the bus station. Brickall texted her as she was climbing onto the coach for the 2-hour trip to Faro.
"You on your way to the Algarve?"
"I'm now on leg 2 of the journey. It's a remake of Planes, Trains and Automobiles." Her own leg was very painful after nearly 6 hours in the car, but she kept thinking of Howard's warning about opioid abuse and avoided taking more painkillers. Instead, she gratefully accepted a plastic tumbler of wine from one of her fellow travellers and slept most of the way over the border. At 9 p.m, Tiago's bar was about half full. No doubt revellers were thinner on the ground in October than during the summer season, but it had been a hot day and people were lingering at the beach for one last cold beer and to watch the informal volleyball match that was taking place. Rachel sat at one of the plastic tables and ordered a glass of vino verde and, because she hadn't eaten all day and was ravenous, a paper plate of chips. There was only one waitress serving, and Rachel beckoned her over and showed her the photo of Gavin Harper sitting outside this very bar.
"Do you know him?"
She shook her head.
"Sorry, I know English."
But there was something there in her eyes, a flicker of recognition. After she had wolfed the chips, Rachel took her glass of wine and wandered a few yards away to a rocky outcrop where she sat down and waited. At about 11, the sound system was switched on, complete with flashing strobe lights, and gradually more people started to arrive, spilling out onto the sand in a rowdy gaggle. Cigarette tips lit the night sky like fireflies, and there was a heady whiff of marijuana. Suddenly, Rachel spotted a familiar figure strolling along the fairy light-bedecked path that led from street to beach. She had been looking at him for the past 2 days, so there was no doubt in her mind. Gavin Harper. She waited until he was a few feet from the front of the bar, then walked over.
"Excuse me?"
He froze. "Gavin Harper, I need to talk to you." He thrust his chin down, spun on his heel and started sprinting back towards the road. Rachel dropped her beer bottle and took off after him, but her sandals gave her no purchase on the uneven sand and she stumbled. Once she was on the path, she steadied herself, but the torn ligament made it impossible to pick up any pace, and Gavin had vanished into the maze of darkened streets. Fuck! Wincing with pain, Rachel bent double to catch her breath, then limped back to the sanctuary of her hotel. Chapter 8. If Rachel Prince had a temperamental default setting, then it was stubborn. But on this occasion, She was forced to accept that she needed backup. Waking up the next morning in her basic hotel bedroom, she decided she would phone Patton and discuss the possibility of more personnel being sent from London. He wasn't available, but she was at least able to ask Jeanette to email a copy of the reported sighting of Lola Jade in Portugal. A British holidaymaker had phoned the police information line while they were on holiday in Albufeira. "My wife and I were on the way to the beach and we saw a youngish man with brown hair leading a blonde girl along Rua de Bateria. We agree that it looked a bit like Lola Jade Harper and she was around the right age. She didn't appear upset or distressed." But the date was the 3rd of August, and Gavin Harper disappeared from Eastwell in late October. Perhaps someone else took Lola to Portugal and kept her there for a while until Gavin could slip away without suspicion. His brother Andy? She texted Brickell. "Try and find out if Andy Whittier left the country during July or August." Before she could do anything else, she needed caffeine. She wandered into the old town with its pretty mosaic-tiled streets and sat outside a tiny pastelleria with a coffee and a pastry. It was still early and the narrow street fairly empty, so Rachel had a good view of the people who were strolling past. Her heart lurched in her chest when she spotted him. He was wearing sunglasses and had a baseball cap pulled down low. But the dolphin tattoo on his arm gave him away. Gavin Harper. Rachel leapt to her feet, almost knocking over her table, and walked briskly but unobtrusively down the street after him, gaining on him before he had the chance to spot her. He sensed rather than saw her and broke into a run, but shoppers and gossiping locals disrupted his sprint, allowing Rachel to get close enough to grab his T-shirt. "Hey, stop, I need to talk to you." A gaggle of people gathered, attracting the attention of a uniformed National Guard. Thinking Rachel was being mugged, he drew his bat on and pinioned a resistant Gavin by the wrist. "Get the fuck off me," he snarled, trying to struggle free from the guard's grip, lashing out with his free arm. Rachel wrestled her Interpol warrant card from her jeans pocket and showed it to the guard. He nodded and muttered a few words into his airwave set, and within seconds a police van arrived and Gavin Harper was bundled unceremoniously inside. "Where's Lola Jade?" Rachel sat opposite Gavin Harper in an interview room at the local headquarters of the Guardia Nacional Republicana. She had been at pains to explain that he wasn't yet under arrest, but that it was in his best interest to talk to her.
"I don't know," he spoke angrily. "You can't keep me here, Constable."
"Detective Inspector, Prince."
"Detective Inspector, I've done nothing wrong. I haven't done anything to Lola, I swear on my life."
She looked into his eyes. He looked straight back, unflinching.
"So why on earth did you leave the UK and go on the run?"
"Because everyone was pointing the finger at me and I couldn't deal with it. I needed to get away."
Rachel was skeptical.
"Without even telling anyone? Not even your brother?"
His face clouded slightly.
"I didn't want any hassle for them. I didn't want them being asked about where I was."
"But if you'd done nothing wrong, why would they be hassled? And why were people pointing the finger at you?" She made quote marks. "In the first place."
Gavin shrugged.
"Because me and Michelle were getting divorced, and it was getting very messy."
Rachel made a mental note to revisit the divorce proceedings.
"Okay, forget the why for a second. How did you do it? You were on an international watch list, but there's no record of you leaving the UK."
He spoke coldly this time. "I'm not going to answer any more questions, not without a lawyer."
Rachel ignored this.
"So the semen traces found on the floor of Lola's room containing your DNA?"
She folded her arms, but kept her voice level and unemotional.
"I just told you I'm not answering questions."
Rachel sighed. Suddenly overwhelmed with tiredness and the longing for Brickell's infuriating yet reassuring presence. Double-handed interviews work so much better.
"If you want an English-speaking lawyer, that's going to take a while to organise. In the meantime, you're going to be the guest of these nice Portuguese gentlemen."
The body search conducted during Gavin's booking revealed a labelled set of keys for an apartment block on the Rua Sel Aguas. With him locked in a police cell, Rachel and a young garda called Bruno drove there, gloved up, and began a fingertip search of the third-floor one-bedroom apartment. There wasn't much to examine. Just a rucksack with a few clothes in it, a charger in a box that had held a cheap disposable mobile phone, and an iPod plugged into a portable speaker. There was milk and beer in the kitchen fridge, a half-eaten box of breakfast cereal and some tea bags in the cupboard. One toothbrush, some deodorant, and a disposable razor in the bathroom. A couple of towels had been used, and both sides of the bed appeared to have been slept in. Bruno bagged the towel, the toothbrush, and the bed linen for DNA sampling. The nightstand's drawer revealed a passport and credit card in the name of Andy Whittier. So that was how he had done it, exploiting the resemblance between himself and his brother. Rachel handed them to Bruno to bag.
We finish now?
Hold on, one second. Something made Rachel go back to the rucksack and re-examine it, turning it inside out. There was a padded interior pocket, which she unzipped, pulling out a small child's nightgown. White jersey material scattered with red, yellow and blue stars. The label said ages 5 to 7. She held it up.
Meu Deus,
breathed Bruno. Quite. She bagged it up, and once they had retrieved the building's CCTV recordings from the management office, they drove fast back to the Guardia Nacional building, with Bruno pressing the heel of his palm frequently on the car horn. Rachel spent the next 2.5 hours reviewing the CCTV footage from the apartment block, but the only images of Gavin were of him alone. She asked for him to be released from the cell and brought back into the interview room, where she laid the nightdress on the table between them. "Recognize this?" He looked surprised. "Where did you find that?" "In your rucksack. It's about to go to our forensic lab to be tested. My bet is that it's going to have 2 sets of DNA on it, yours and Lola's." "It must have been in there for ages. I used that rucksack when Lola and I went to a campsite in Rill last summer. My cousin has a place down there." Rachel kept her expression neutral. "We'll corroborate that, obviously. Right, I've requested a lawyer and a translator who are going to come and speak to you." "How long will that take?" "A few hours. But the GNR here are going to remand you in custody anyway while I get a European arrest warrant issued." "You can't fucking arrest me, I haven't done anything." His body language was pure aggression, and Rachel thought back to the photos of Michelle's bruised arms. "I'm afraid you have," she said coolly. "Use of a false identity document happens to be an indictable offence. That means extradition rules apply. In other words, the Portuguese authorities now have to send you back to face trial, and I get the undoubted pleasure of escorting you back to the UK." "Fuck's sake, you can't do this!" He slammed the flat of his hand on the table. She paused in the doorway as Bruno and one of his friends pulled Gavin to his feet. "Carry on like this, and you're going to be travelling home in a pair of steel bracelets." The flight from Faro landed at Gatwick the following evening. As soon as Rachel had handed over Gavin Harper and the exhibits to a uniformed team from Surrey Police, she texted Brickall. "Found Harper. He's got some explaining to do." He replied straight away, "We're all at the pin, loser." Succinct, she thought, and also insolent. Par for the course. She went back to her flat, showered and changed out of her grimy travelling clothes, applied some makeup, then headed to their work local, the Pin and Needle.
"Look what the cat dragged in," crowed Brickall.
But he gave her a comradely slap on the shoulder and bought her a glass of red wine. The place was crowded, but they carved out a couple of feet of space at the bar.
"Still in a good mood, I see," Rachel observed. "Oh, crap."
She had just spotted a familiar figure on the far side of the bar. "Howard. My personal trainer," she explained to Brickall. "I wasn't expecting to see him here."
"Oh, a personal trainer now, is it? Get you."
Brickall was tipsy, but not too tipsy to notice the faint pinkness in Rachel's cheeks, or the way she kept glancing over in Howard's direction,
Oh, I get it, he said with satisfaction. Get what? You fancy him, don't you? It's obvious.
Rachel shook her head rather too vigorously. Fuck off, Brickle, it's not that. We had an argument and I was rude to him.
That never stopped you before.
She gave him the finger before jostling herself out of the corner she was penned into and limping in Howard's direction. He did a comedy double-take when he saw her, and she realized it was because he hadn't immediately recognized her, with her freshly styled hair, tailored shirt and red lipstick, complementing her newly acquired Mediterranean glow. He was used to seeing her barefaced and in sweaty disarray at the gym.
Hi, she said. Can I get you a drink?
He shook his head.
I'm with my wife.
He pointed at a table at the far side of the room, where an attractive red-headed woman was sitting with that awkward air of the pub-goer who doesn't yet have a drink.
Oh, I see, she collected herself. Sorry, I didn't realize you were married.
He held up his left hand, displaying a gold band.
Not a good idea to wear a wedding ring while you're boxing.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say sorry. I was rude to you. About the tramadol.
He smiled, showing she was forgiven. How is the knee?
Rachel had to stop and consider her answer, which in turn made her realize she hadn't thought about it for a while.
A bit better, I think. Yes, definitely better. And you were right about the pills. I should be careful with them.
There was an awkward pause.
Well, I guess I'll see you at the gym, now I'm back.
Sure. Howard gave her a brief smile, then wove his way to the table where his wife was sitting. She was staring in Rachel's direction, and the displeasure on her face was unsettling. Rachel used what limited space she had to pivot through 180 degrees and squeezed back through the crush to Brickle.
Trial over, then, is it? She asked him. He nodded. So, no more hot lawyer, then?
He grinned. Au contraire, Prince. I fully intend there will be plenty more of the hot lawyer.
Any day now, she and I are going to be going on a date.
Have you asked her?
He shook his head. But I'm going to, don't you worry. And how about you? Amazing that you arrested Gavin Harper.
Good work. Rachel inclined her head over her glass, acknowledging this rare praise, then took a deep gulp of her wine. Her eyes flicked involuntarily in the direction of Howard and his wife, who were still looking daggers at her.
But obviously he didn't have the kid, or we'd all know about it by now.
No, he didn't, but I'm pretty certain he's involved in her disappearance somehow, and as soon as he's got a brief, I'm going to get to the bottom of it.
Certain? That's a dirty word round here, Prince.
Okay, not certain then. There's some evidence to suggest he might be. Despite his teasing tone, she was confident that Brickle would trust her hunch.
I checked on Whittier's movements, he added. He did go to the Med in August, but it was Mallorca, not Portugal. So what next?
Gavin's currently in a custody suite at Eastwell Nick. I'll need to interview him again with a lawyer present this time. And then we need to make some follow-up inquiries. She drained her wine glass, which will probably start with us going back to visit Michelle Harper.
Chapter 9. Gavin Harper was now represented by an experienced criminal solicitor called Robert Neely, but for Rachel's purposes this made little difference. He still wasn't saying very much.
I've got nothing to tell you, he insisted. Not above what I've already told you. I was freaking out from all the attention and I legged it to Portugal to get away for a bit. There's nothing wrong with that.
Apart from the tiny matter of using a false passport, Rachel said dryly.
Because I knew if I used my own there'd be hassle, after stuff that Michelle said about me.
Why didn't you tell anyone?
I did, though, didn't I? I told Andy.
Why didn't you tell anyone else?
Why should I? Not like I was on bail or house arrest.
All right. So what about the night when Lola was taken?
Robert Neely leaned across.
My client has already made a statement to police about that.
They went round in circles like this for a while, with Gavin alternately mulish and aggressive,
until Neely said that he wouldn't be answering any further questions, but would instead provide a prepared statement definitively setting out his position. It was a classic stall from the criminal law playbook. Reluctantly, Rachel left them to it and went to join Brickell in Willow Way.